Welcome to the Norris Group's Real Estate Radio Show. Hosted by author, investor, hard money lender, and real estate educator, Bruce Norris. Equipping California real estate professionals for tomorrow's challenges.
Hi, thank you for joining us. My name is Bruce Norris, and today our special guest is John Caraval. John was born in Minneapolis in 1951. His family moved to Norway, where he was raised, educated, and married. He worked as a journalist in Oslo for 10 years and joined a Scandinavian business publication in New York in 1983. In 87, he got pulled in the world of data, mining large databases for trends. He's worked for TRW, CDB, Infotech, Axiom, and others. His relationship with San Diego-based DataQuick Information Systems goes back to 1989, and the statistics he generates are used by public agencies, lending institutions, title companies, etc. All right, John, welcome back.
Thank you.
One of the things that's been obvious in the last 12 months, if you're in the business of selling properties, which I am, we have an inventory usually of 50 houses that are for sale, and it's become increasingly obvious there's less and less to compete against, and that there are still enough buyers out there, and now they're kind of beating each other up to get something. One of the problems is lack of inventory, another is a competitor that's probably going to pay cash.
Oh, boy. And right now, we have the highest level of cash buying that we have in our statistics there. In the Inland Empire, it's roughly 40% of the buyers are paying cash. Southern California as a whole, it's about 30% paying cash. It's really hard to get in and compete with that, even if you go in with, say, a pre-approved offer from your lender. It still takes, an appraisal and all sorts of stuff, and they're just losing out there. I go to this conference up at the Department of Finance that we have up there once a year, and a bunch of the number crunchers look at various things. And I think the last time around, they're one of the biggest issues that everybody thinks is going to emerge is this pent-up demand out there. There is just an awful lot of buying activity which has been put on hold. We have to remember that, demand is generated by just the most mundane of things. People move to an area, they leave, they graduate from college, they get divorced, they have kids, they die, they all of these things generate demand. And the demand that has been met the past 6 years has been really just a fraction of the demand that's being generated out there. So no matter how you do the numbers, it appears that there's an incredible amount of pent-up demand out there. It's not just the boomerang kids who've gone back to live with their parents after they finish college. It's retirees who want to retire somewhere. There's just a whole bunch of people just want to move closer to work, and it's stuck. And what we're seeing now with prices off bottom, we have to remember that was a psychological turn right there. It's hard to buy something if you think it's going to go down in value. It's a lot easier to buy it if you think it's going up in value. And right now, I think people understand that it's very likely that property values are just going to continue to go up for a while. And so they're out there looking. We've been hearing about open houses now in North San Diego County and, in Southern Riverside County, as well as a lot of L.A. there, where you literally can't get in the door. You can't get in the door. People are lined up outside waiting to walk through the living room and kitchen. And it's just all of a sudden it just hit. And so it'll be interesting to see just exactly how much that demand pushes prices up between now and summer.
Well, one of the things that was unprecedented is the number of foreclosures that happened in 07, 08. Well, when you can qualify for a loan 3 years later, you create an unprecedented demand on top of normal demand. And I think that's where a lot of it's coming from, but they haven't been able to buy because you've just said that 40% of the market's cash buyer beating them out. So they're still in the hunt, but they haven't been satisfied yet.
Nope, they're out there looking, and they just and we have to remember too that there is a lag between the agreed upon purchase price and when that's agreed upon and when the appraisal comes in. If we go back 2 years, 2.5 years, I was at a conference, and the CAR representative there said that over half of the escrows were dying. because the appraisals weren't coming in anywhere near where they need to be. Now, my understanding now is that the appraisals, it's a bit better, but it's still very, very bad out there. If you go out there and you make a bid and you even have, financed or pre-qualified for your financing there, there's a good chance that the appraisal is going to be based on the last, the 3 months' worth of sales activity, and it's just not going to come in where you need it to come in.
Yeah, the appraisal world is lagging the real world at least by 45 days, the time it takes for those transactions to close, and especially in FHA areas where a buyer just can't arbitrarily say, I want it anyway, here's 20 grand. If you're in a conventional market, let's say you go from Hesperia, what, like I just mentioned, would be FHA predominantly, Corona would be maybe an all-cash market even for an occupant owner or Fannie Mae financing, you'll have people pay a 5 or 10% premium just to get one, and then becomes a comp.
Yeah, exactly.
So
yeah.
The market proves that the appraiser is behind because they wanted it bad enough to close it anyway.
Yeah. This will probably self-balance itself at some point. I remember, and probably you do too, back in the late 80s, early 90, up to 1990 there, one of the ways that that pressure was eased was by carrying a second. Now, the lenders, which would mean that if you're selling a piece of property, you sell it for $350,000. Well, the bank says, well, we only think it's worth $300,000 because of the appraisal, and we're only going to lend 20% on it, and the person has maybe a $250,000 down payment. So all of a sudden, there's money that just isn't there, so you'd carry a second.
Okay.
And that was, probably about one-third of all the sales from 1989 through 1991. Were facilitated by this, the seller carrying a second.
And the lender being willing to let that occur.
Well, see, that was the, this is where things get a little bit fussy. See, the lenders, this happened kind of after the lenders. A lot of the lenders said, no, we don't want that to happen, and people did.
Okay.
But the thing is that if you've bought a property and it's financed and everything's recorded and all that kind of stuff, the lender can't go up to you after the fact and say, oh, by the way, you can't use this property as security for a loan, even if it's on top of the one we've put out there. So people did that. Seconds were big. They were big back there at that time.
In general, when you have price increases, like we both think are probably going to occur for a while, do lenders look at that and go, okay, well, we can become a little more aggressive with our policies?
You can, they did, and I expect them to. That's DITEC, 1997. It's somebody going out there and saying, okay, we're going to go out there and make our loans based on what we think is happening out there. Now, it can't happen now. You're talking Dodd-Frank, I'm talking psycho bean counters at, the banks and stuff. But I think that if an aggressive lender comes in and says, okay, we're not going to give you a 4% 30-year fixed on this, we're going to give you a 6% 30-year fixed on it. But we will let, the agreed-upon sales price constitute the actual sales price of this, and we'll go forward with it. So that's where you have those 2%, that little margin in there. And that's what you have as a part of a differentiated, good, healthy mortgage market, where you have everybody making all kinds of different loans for different purposes. And I think that's going to come back.
And it's pretty absent right now, though.
Oh, take a look at, stated income. You remember?
Sure.
If you pile stated income on top of a low down payment, on top of an ARM, on top of the NEGAM, that's a recipe for disaster. But the stated income stuff, that originally came about, I'm self-employed, as we mentioned here, So it's a stated income. I have to go out there and show all sorts of documentation out there. But basically, as a self-employed person out there, it's a stated income thing, and so those are appropriate loans for that. My wife's a physician, and a lot of her colleagues out there, they're self-employed physicians. Well, they don't have an employment history; they're self-employed, and so a stated income loan is absolutely perfect for them. They just go out there and they get that stated income loan. So my point being that all of these loans, whether it's a negative amortization or interest only or whatever, they're all appropriate for their specific circumstances. It's just that we had the loans gone wild crazy period there, where these people unfettered went loose on the market there, and nobody reined them in, and they're causing us all that problem. One thing, I always thought it was interesting anyway. There was one person at a conference I was at who brought up the one of the most controversial types of loans. And she went back to the 60s. And I said, well, what loan is that? She said, you won't remember this, she said, but the most controversial new loan characteristic out there for home loans, she said, was when they decided to let spousal income become a part of the qualifying process. So it was before then, it was strictly the breadwinner's income and nothing on the side. After, and you know, it was basically wives' incomes count. And when that came in, she said that was much, much more controversial and much, and there were a lot of naysayers there who were looking at those loans when they came. You know, I grew up in Norway, for example. ARMs are what people use there. The fixed rate loans just, they're just not used.
What are the down payments there?
Oh, 25-30%.
Okay. So, yeah, one of the chapters I did, because I thought things were going to change, and I thought, okay, well, how do other countries finance things? And, yeah, you find that, okay, 30-year fixed, that's not normal.
No, but I mean, in Norway, you know, you can get a 20% down loan. You can get a 10% down loan. They're more expensive, and they're harder to qualify for. And it's a little bit different over there. The rules and the laws are a little bit different there and stuff.
If you have a lender finally break the ice and say, okay, well, this is perfectly safe, it would seem to me that as soon as they have a track record of getting paid, somebody else is going to go, okay, well, here we go. And then we're off and running with somewhat of a program.
Well, and it's got to happen. And this is where things get really interesting. Because if you go and talk to these lenders, they'll say, well, you know, a lot of the loans made, in fact, most of the loans made by the lenders there are still bought by investors, whether it's the government of late there. It used to be all sorts of other investors out there, pension funds, whatnot. They're saying now that there's just no stomach for risk.
Right.
And I'm not sure that that's the case. I think they may think that's the case, but I have heard in other contexts out here that there is a lot of money, especially foreign money, just stacked up and waiting to jump into the market there. But they're just not finding, and they're looking for ARMs. The one I heard about there, which was tens of billions of dollars waiting to go out there and be invested in ARMs, and none of the lenders here were willing to bundle a bunch of ARMs for them so that they could invest in it. But the returns are going to be good. You know, right now, what do you? If you're a pension fund and you're out there looking to park, you know, $10 billion a month, whether it's, you know, a teacher's fund somewhere or a public employee fund somewhere else or something like that, what are you going to do with that money? You know, you can't put it into a saving. I mean, obviously, they're not going to put it into a savings account, but what are we getting in a savings account now? What, 2.25%, yeah, something like that? It's just ridiculous.
Yeah, that's the flip side of, okay, grab great rates to borrow, but then you have people with money going, I don't want to do it.
Yeah, exactly.
Especially on a 30-year term, that's for sure.
Yeah, exactly. So I do think that this is going to cascade at some point and become more and more available. And I just don't want it to get the way it became back in 2006, 2007. I remember when I went to a meeting, and it was a Wachovia, and I remember listening to these people talking about how they were originating mortgages out there. And I, you know, shame on me, but I was not aware of this, you know, mirror in front of the mouth qualification type thing there. You know, you fog the mirror, you get your loan. And they were using that exact analogy and laughing about it. And I thought, what the heck is going on here?
But they weren't keeping the paper. You know, yeah, it was after the fact, too, for me. I didn't know what a collateralized debt obligation was or a mortgage-backed security, for that matter, until probably mid-07 when I really studied it and went, you got to be kidding me.
Yeah.
And the other people on the other side betting against it with credit default swaps.
Yeah, yeah.
And then you find out sometimes they have the same hat on.
Yeah, yeah.
And you're just going, you got to be kidding.
Yeah,
and so
yeah,
we deserve sort of what happened. But going forward now, you know, you've got one of the things that's interesting in California, and I'm sure they've been in Nevada and Phoenix and other places, is the hedge fund world is really played havoc with the private buyer trying to get inventory that they would have to finance, because these guys are coming in with all cash offers and buying everything in sight. So, mm-hmm, you know, it's the first time I'm pretty Republican, I guess. And it's the first time I thought, you know what, maybe that's really not the best place for that big old pile of money.
Well, you know, it's, but it is going to, you know, it is capitalism. I'm, you know, I'm growing up in Scandinavia there. I'm at wildly at the opposite end of the political spectrum there, but I do believe in a good, strong market. I just think that people need to be, reined in, and that it should be a level playing field for everybody, and it wasn't. If you go back to that 2006-2007 period there, it was not a level playing field there on all counts, and it took me a long time to understand what one of those debt obligations actually was. Mm-hmm. And if you go and you look at those all the derivatives there, it's just astonishing what went on and how little regulation there was there. Yeah, the deregulation, pardon me, but that deregulation that opened up that spigot there was not a good thing for the economy or the world. It just went nuts.
No, and the thought that they would rein them in themselves turned out to be not true.
They're not going to do that. What we had was basically a chain of participants there, all of whom made their money on commission. So there were no grown-ups up there saying, "Oh, hey, you know, stop that." Everybody in the chain, from the local originator at the local office all the way up the chain to the guy who was packaging this stuff on Wall Street there, they were all making their money basically on commission. And, you know, if you've got a bunch of salespeople making, I mean, you need salespeople out there, but the salespeople need to have managers who are,
or at least connected to the real world.
Who know what the rules are.
And at the end of the day, it really didn't help everybody. They made a bunch of money, and then if that's the only thing they knew how to do, they've basically been out of business for 5 years.
Well, it was funny money. You know, you take a look, it's, you know, I mean, those derivatives there, it's basically, it's, you know, money should reflect an underlying value of some kind, whether it's a productivity of some kind or a tangible of some kind or something like that. But when you go look at those derivatives there, they were
synthetic CDO.
Yeah, you know, it was like you and I investing money in somebody's life insurance policy, and then we start selling what we've invested in it. It just went nuts.
Inventory right now is, in some areas, is a month. Or month and a half.
Well, we're hearing days in the Sacramento area.
Yeah, that's right. I just woke up there, and it literally was days.
Yeah.
How does that reverse and get back to a normal inventory level if lenders are not going to come up with the REOs, and it doesn't look like they are, and short sales probably are, they've been pretty consistent. It really is the only place it can come from is that equity owner, mm-hmm. and in Sacramento, for instance, half of them don't have it.
Mm-hmm. So, but you know, obviously the solution to that, you know, that's economics 101.
Have to go up.
Yeah.
Well, I guess that's, you know, that's obviously, but for 2013, I don't see how the inventory grows to months and months supply. It's going to have more demand than it's got supply for the entire year, or maybe a year or two, it seems to me.
Only if we keep that lag. You know, you'd mentioned that 6-week lag between the appraisal, or when sales actually occur, and when that appraisal can come in at a proper number there. That'll have to shrink down. In addition to which, you know, we're just bouncing off bottom right now. And so the trajectory, or the velocity of the bounce up off bottom now, is the fastest. So once the bounce gets further up off the bottom, a little more gravity will exert itself and pull back a little bit there. But there is, keep in mind, you know, that with these low interest rates here, and people, they're just, a rise in prices is just in the cards. And it's just going to keep going until there's a equilibrium of some kind. And it's probably going to go up fairly strongly, at least between now and the summer.
You know, what's interesting about equilibrium is that, I mean, it's hard to get if you only have 2 months supply of inventory. Then you still have a huge push. But it seems like once people start making a lot of money on their real estate, it doesn't end until it's numerically impossible to qualify. I mean, that's usually the history. It gains momentum instead of slacks.
Yeah.
And it's human nature.
Yeah. No, it is. And we keep in mind, though, you know, right now we're probably going to have this period of time here where we dip into that pent-up demand that's out there. So there's going to be a period now of kind of stuff going very well. But at some point, it's going to level off there a bit. And then the regular stuff is going to exert itself there. You know, household incomes, you know, how much money have you saved up? Can you play with a self-directed IRA to put, you know, to finance your home? All this other stuff is going to start to exert itself. And I think there too, you know, we have demographics, you know, we just, the baby boomer generation of which I'm a part of there, you know, they were just a big old hump on the curve, and we're, that's past us. So a lot of that force that was built into that is probably going to dissipate, and it'll go back to the basics, which is probably very good. It'll be, how much demand is there out there? Keep in mind, though, too, you know, there hasn't been much building going on the past 6 years, and no matter how you do the numbers there, there are too few houses, especially here in California. And how that plays out is going to be very interesting there.
What's interesting about what you said, and Cal Poly produces that report, and I think it's the only place that actually counts subdivisions. And subdivisions are down by 95% in Riverside County, which is where building would obviously take place. You can't catch up with subdivisions. You can't end up with finished lots tomorrow if you decide it's finally okay to do a subdivision.
No, but they were actually pretty good. You know, there was some consolidation out there, but the builders were pretty good about keeping those pipelines active. So there are an awful lot of projects that were just being incrementally pushed through the pipeline, just barely, and you can crank it up a little bit. I know I've been watching a couple of them out there, and they're going to be able to crank it up, but nothing compared to what the demand is going to be. Nothing compared to what the demand is going to be. And keep in mind, you know, compared to, you remember the last boom of, 86, 87, 89 there, when the builders were building like crazy. They were building a lot of really crummy stuff then. There were an awful lot of boxes being put up in long lines on asphalt roads and stuff like that up in the high desert, and they were not very well thought through. The stuff we're looking at now, and the stuff that was built too up from 2004, 2005, 2006, those were well thought through projects. They were actually pretty good. If you go cruising around down in Murrieta or, you know, Temecula,
they're just all 4,000 square feet.
Yeah, there's an awful lot of that big stuff out there, an awful lot of it. But, you know, the neighborhoods are nice, the homes are nice. You know, they've planned for schools, planned for parks, they've planned for a commercial development, and they did a pretty good job. It's not like driving around, you know, the Palmdale stuff that got built in 88.
Well, you know, what you just said, though, also takes time. So if you start breaking ground tomorrow on the next one, you're going to have to go through all of those approvals, and it doesn't come out of the ground for a while.
You know, and it's interesting. You know, I fly these little ultralight airplanes out of Paris. Mm-hmm. It's basically a flying go-kart. And we don't go all that far. But we go, you know, 20, 30 miles around there. And there are a ton of these projects that we just fly over. And we look down, you know, the mile between our toes dangling out there in the clouds. And then look down at the ground down there. And you'll see where they developed. They brought the development as far as they could before they pulled the plug on it. So there are 400 or 500 lots in these beautiful little half circles there around, whatever. But they kept them active. So there were always two or three houses being built right at the end of some street. And there was always just something going on. And now, just the past 3 months there, all of a sudden, you're going around there, and all of a sudden, it's not two or three. They've got 12, or they got 25 or something there going on. They still have plenty of other lots there.
Okay.
And the lots never degraded that badly, but they're still building. But it's now starting to come online. It's interesting to watch.
What's your opinion, and we only have a minute left, if interest rates start to go up, what do you think the reaction of the buying public would be?
Oh, we know it'll be that there's a rush to go out there and buy and get in before it goes up even further.
Right. Not only did they miss out on the bottom of the price, but now they don't want to miss out on the interest rate, too.
Exactly.
I think a lot of people think that will be the opposite, but that isn't true.
Nope. I don't think so. I don't think so. And remember, I moved to the country here in, 83, and back then people were talking about their 17% mortgages.
I had one.
Yeah.
I refied in 1981 to become an investor at 17.5%.
Oh, my.
And then when I paid it off with a 12, I thought, wow. Yeah. What a neat deal that was.
Oh, I remember. Yeah, I remember when it went below 10.
Oh,
and
yeah.
Everybody was saying, oh, this is temporary. It's going to go right back up to 18 again, and it never did.
Yeah. Well, what's interesting is that what we'll see in the future could be the other end of that chart. So, John, we've run out of time. John Caravel, thanks so much for joining me.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Enjoyed it a lot.
You've been listening to the Norris Group Real Estate Radio Show. For more information on the Norris Group, please visit www.thenorrisgroup.com.